This is The Radical Therapist, a space where we explore the intersections of collaborative therapy, philosophy, art, and science and technology in a post-Freud, post-psychology world.
Welcome to The Radical Therapist. This is your host, Chris Hoff, and we are now at episode number 40. And I'm contemplating possibly changing the name of The Radical Therapist to, at the suggestion of today's guest, Dr. Dina Weisberg. She suggested the possibility of The Radical Neurotherapist because her work is all around the seductive allure of neuroscience explanations. And she seemed to think, half jokingly, that if I were to make a name change to The Radical Neurotherapist, that I might get a lot of mileage out of that. What do you all think? Let me know, theradicaltherapist@gmail.com. Have a wonderful show for you today. I really enjoyed this conversation. I think you're really going to enjoy Dr. Weisberg's take on what's going on currently in the neuroscience world and the psychology world. And it was just a great conversation. Really looking forward to sharing it with you. But before I do that, I have a couple of announcements. The first one is I am going to be at the Building on the Legacy of Michael White, a Decade of Narrative Developments conference in San Diego. This is a narrative gathering that's being put on by Narrative Initiative San Diego, and I think a collaboration with Reauthoring Teaching, Peggy Sachs and Reauthoring Teaching. And it's just going to be a nice three-day event, a lot of great content. But what I'm kind of throwing out there, I wanted to see what our listeners, if anybody's going to be there, And if so, I'm contemplating putting together a Radical Therapist event during the conference, maybe go to a bar on Thursday night or something. I got a couple of previous guests that are going to be there and would want to get together, and we can have some conversations and talk about, you know, whatever, and just kind of meet up and just kind of, you know, meet some of the people. It'd be wonderful. So if that sounds interesting to you, I would love to hear from you at theradicaltherapist@gmail.com. Shoot me a message. Let me know if you're going to be in San Diego on March 28th, 29th, or 30th. And if that's something you'd be interested in, let's get together, hang out. That would be fun. And finally, my last announcement is The Radical Therapist has a YouTube channel. It'd be wonderful if you went and checked it out. I have a goal this year to get to 1,000 subscribers. I'm over a third of the way there. So I would love if you would jump on YouTube and check out The Radical Therapist YouTube channel. A lot of great content up there so far and more coming that I think you would appreciate, or I hope you would. Also, you know, the comment section in YouTube is just worth it in and of itself. So you definitely want to check that out. So please, if you would go, if you're into YouTube or you like watching videos, I mean, even if you're an educator or you do workshops or whatever, maybe some of these videos might be useful to you. I don't know, but go check them out and would love your support. So that's it for announcements. And I think it's now time to get to our guest. And just so you know, Dr. Dina Weisberg is a senior fellow in the Department of Psychology at the University of Pennsylvania, where she directs the Cognition and Development Lab and co-directs the Penn Laboratory for Understanding Science. Her research interests include the development of imaginative cognition, the role that the imagination plays in learning, and scientific thinking and reasoning in children and adults. And I think you're really going to enjoy this conversation. I did. So without further ado, let's meet Dr. Dina Weisberg. Hello, Dr. Weisberg. Thank you for being on the show.
Hello. It's a pleasure to be here.
Great. Okay. So to get started, I thought maybe you could let our listeners know you do a lot of things, and one of them is directing the Cognition and Development Lab at the Penn Laboratory for Understanding Science. And I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit, the multiple things that you do, if you could tell us a little bit about what you do and what your role there is at the University of Pennsylvania, et cetera, et cetera.
Sure, absolutely. So I'm currently a senior fellow in the Department of Psychology at the University of Pennsylvania. And as you mentioned, I manage two labs, but the uniting theme that really ties all of the research that I do together is thinking about science. Mm. So thinking about how adults learn different scientific facts and how they think scientifically, examining children to learn how they learn to reason scientifically and how their learning of new scientific information might interact with other cognitive capacities that they are developing. So it sounds like a lot, but really, you know, all of the projects that I do kind of fall under that general umbrella of thinking about how do people think about science, both the process of science and also scientific content.
That's great and needed. In this day and age. So your research, the reason I guess I wanted to reach out to you, because I just found it really fascinating, and for several reasons that we'll get to in some of the questions I'm going to ask you, but your research has determined that neuroscience information has found that neuroscience information is more satisfying than explanations without neuroscience information. Mm-hmm. Especially bad explanations. Mm-hmm. And in our field, I don't know if you see some of this, but in our field, we're seeing more trainings. And by our field, I mean in the therapy, social work, counseling fields, right? We're seeing more trainings and workshops that are using language such as somatic, sensory motor, psychotherapy, interpersonal neurobiology, neurogenesis and neuroplasticity, and unlocking the emotional brain, and neurotherapy, and neural reorganization. I could go on, right?
Yep.
And so I'm wondering, is most of this just neuromyths, or is there something to this, right?
Well, it's a little bit of both.
Okay.
Is my impression. So not having actually attended any of these sessions to see what's being presented, I think there is a good deal of hype. And I think that one thing my research shows is that people are definitely attracted to topics that have some reference to the brain, or that people are kind of more willing to think of them as being scientific or as being serious or as presenting relevant information and so on. I think in some ways that people running these workshops or trying to provide these resources are savvy about that and are kind of taking advantage of it. You know, why call it therapy when we could call it neurotherapy?
Yeah, right.
And maybe that'll bring them in the door. Yeah. So I do think there is an element of that going on to a certain extent. There is also the flip side, which is that, of course, that's true, right? If you're doing therapy, you have to be doing neurotherapy in some sense. That, you know, that's not wrong.
Right.
You're whatever you're doing is affecting somebody's brain. You're affecting their mind, which is contingent upon what's going on in their brain. So, you know, I think there's been that struggle. I'm more familiar with it in education, which is a field that I am a little bit more closely aligned with because of my work with children. And there's a lot of the same kind of issues going on there. Where there's a lot of this neuroeducation or educational neuroscience is kind of a burgeoning field. Mm-hmm. And, you know, some of it is not very good science, but, you know, some of it does have some merit. I think it really is going to be a matter of trying to dig into what people are actually saying rather than how they're labeling it, and then trying to separate the wheat from the chaff.
Yeah, which we'll get to, but... Again, you know, currently, you read the news or just on your Facebook page, whatever, there's rarely a day that goes by without hearing about another advance in neurobiology of human behavior. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering, as, you know, therapists or counselors or social workers being non-neuroscientists, how we might wade through these explanations so that we don't get captured by the next new thing that isn't actually based in, you know, real or solid science or ideas that have been stretched by psychologists beyond the original research. And I'm wondering how, and I know you've written about this, but how do we deconstruct these explanations?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I want to start by pointing out that this isn't a new problem.
Okay.
You know, there has always been, you know, a lot of overpromise you know, whatever the hot new thing is to come out. So I don't think this is unique to neuroscience. But what that also means is that your listeners and the people that you're talking to already have the tools that they need to deal with this sort of thing. You know, this is something that we've seen before. I think it happens to be particularly seductive in the case of neuroscience. That's the term that I use in my research, just because something about the brain seems to have that really strong attraction for people. But I don't think it's different in kind from things that we've seen before, or other trends in therapy or clinical practice or education that have come around before. So I think the first thing is to be aware that it's a thing that happens.
Mm-hmm. It has been happening for some time, right?
Yeah. Exactly. And to be aware that, you know, people might be a little bit less critical, that, you know, you as a reader or a consumer might naturally be a little bit less critical of material that comes at you when it has this jargon of neuroscience. So, you know, learning that might then help to start overcome it. And then to realize that those are particularly the cases where you need to take a step back and say, okay, let me translate this back into language that doesn't have any of that jargon in it. What is it actually saying? Is this something that is actually going to help me in my practice? Are they promising something that they can actually deliver, and so on?
Great. Okay. Your research also states, and I think this is interesting, your research also states that it's not that neuroscience information itself causes subjects to lose their grip on normally well-functioning judgment processes. Rather, that neuroscience information happens to represent the intersection of a variety of properties that can conspire together to impair judgment. And I guess I'm wondering, what might some of these other properties be, or have you kind of tapped into that combined with a neuroscience explanation causes this lack of critical thinking or impaired judgment?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so that's something that I've been looking at in my more recent work. What I showed previously is that neuroscience has this kind of effect, but we don't quite know why. And so some of the more recent studies in the past couple of years that I've been working on have been trying to answer that why question. And one thing that we found is that neuroscience seems to be a kind of perfect storm of different features that all independently have a seductive effect, and then they're combined in the case of neuroscience. So one of them is the use of an explanation that's reductive. So you can think of science as occurring in a kind of hierarchy from kind of bigger, more abstract things to smaller, more concrete things. So think about the way that a molecule, something you talk about in chemistry, can then be reduced or broken down to a set of atoms that make up that molecule. And so you might think by learning about the atoms, you're also learning something about the operation of the whole molecule. And you can kind of scale that up through this hierarchy of sciences, from physics to chemistry, to biology, to neuroscience, to psychology, to sociology and economics. For example. Mm-hmm. And so one thing that we found is that this kind of effect occurs across all of those sciences. Whenever you take a higher level science in that hierarchy I just described, and then provide an explanation using language from a lower level in the hierarchy, so a biology explanation in terms of chemistry, for example, people think that's better than if you're providing an explanation at the same level of the hierarchy, so a biological explanation for biology. And in our lab, we constructed these very, very carefully so that the actual explanatory material in both of these explanations was the same as judged by experts, but people still think it's better when you've got that reductive language in there. I think that's part of what's happening with neuroscience. Neuroscience is at the proper level in the hierarchy. It's the reductive level for psychology, and for a person level experience, you go down a level and you get to their brain. Mm-hmm. And you can go down further and get to, you know, the mechanisms and the chemicals operating in their brain, and so on. So if you have that reductive information, it seems to work across the board. Mm. So that's one element that is in play here. Another element that's in play in neuroscience in particular, and not necessarily across the sciences, is this question of dualism. So there's other research, not from my lab, but from collaborators and friends and colleagues, showing that people tend to be intuitively dualist, that it's just really easy to think about yourself as being a mind separate from your brain. I think that's just how the first-person experience works, and we have a lot of metaphors in our language that take advantage of that. It sort of feels like there's me. There's, you know, there's a person here, and then there's kind of body that I'm piloting. I like to talk about it like that that alien from the Men in Black movie,
yeah, right.
where there's sort of like the little green guy inside the large body. And I think people tend to think of themselves like that. Like there's some sort of little homunculus that's really you that's kind of piloting this
right.
physical being around.
Right.
You know, and what we know from neuroscience is that that's not actually the case. But what we know from psychology is that people tend to think that that's the case. And when you see evidence from a study of neuroscience that actually something about your mind is being controlled by or is contingent on or can be reduced to something about your brain, people find that very surprising and counterintuitive and interesting, and they're more attracted to it for that reason. So that's something specifically about neuroscience.
Hmm. Are there any other?
Those are two elements.
Okay.
I think the you know, there's a list of other ones that I could give that have not been studied quite as much. Some people have tried to look for an effect of images. So often when you're seeing studies that are described having to do with neuroscience, you're also getting these blobby brain pictures that are very visually attractive and salient and, you know, look better than a graph, for instance, or other kinds of pictures that tend to accompany psychology stories. The evidence on that in the literature is a bit mixed. Some folks claim that they found an effect there and then it failed to replicate. So I'd take that one with a grain of salt. There may well still be something there. There's also just, you know, neuroscience is new and it's in the news a lot, as you say. It's kind of a cyclical prophecy. People like to see it and so there's more of it and then they end up seeing more of it. So it becomes more familiar. There's the issue that they tend to use big expensive equipment and fancy machines. and then the last one that I like to talk about is actually the inverse, which is not that people really, really love neuroscience, which they may for any of these reasons, but also people are really, really dislike psychology. you know, this is a conversation that I have quite a bit as a practicing psychological scientist, which is that, you know, psychology, that's not a science. You know, they tend to think of psychology as being unscientific or as being non-serious in the way that, you know, chemistry, right? You're mixing things in beakers and that really has this kind of sciencey feel to it. And psychology does not have that kind of cachet in the public discourse. And so if you can add something else to psychology to make it seem a little bit more scientific than it otherwise would seem, I think that helps.
That's a great point. Very interesting. Okay, so, and you actually just touched on where my next question was going a couple ways. And I guess I understand it that there is actually a replication crisis currently. I'm thinking of social psychology in particular. I'm thinking of, there's been a lot of press around the power pose and some other stuff that failed to replicate.
Absolutely.
And, yeah.
Yes.
And I also understand there's a growing critique, and you kind of touched on that, of the heavy usage of fMRI and its possible limitations. And I guess I'm wondering what your thoughts about this work, because I did have this idea that that maybe showing a brain scan or something along with whatever you're doing gives you just legitimizes you more, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, there is definitely, crisis might be much, but there's certainly issues with replication happening here in psychology. We're doing a lot of soul searching about methods and measures and so on that you and your listeners may have read or heard about. I think that part of what's going on there is related to one thing I said before, is trying to make psychology more respectable as a science and really taking a step back and taking a look at what is it that we're doing and does this stuff pass muster. So that's kind of part of it. I think I'm losing the thread a little bit because that's not entirely related to the clinical angle that I know you're interested in.
Yeah, well, no, that was good. What are your thoughts as a neuroscientist about the use of fMRI, and is there a critique of it, or?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, I should clarify. I'm not a neuroscientist. Oh, well. I don't actually. Yeah.
Right.
I'm a cognitive psychologist primarily. Yeah. Okay. Cognitive and developmental. So I don't actually perform any neuroscience. So I'm not up on the latest trends. But I will say, one thing that I found fascinating just being around lots of colleagues who do this work is the way that it has grown and changed in the past 10 years and even in the past 5 years. So back when I started this work, when I was a lowly graduate student in 06 and 07, you could get a study published, a neuroscience study published, if you just found that there was some chunk of tissue that lit up for something.
Okay.
There was a lot of what was called somewhat derisively neurophrenology. That you just find the part of the brain that did something. And look, we've found it. Faces are over here, and the visual system's over here, and language is processed over here. And there was a lot of sort of excitement about that. You know, and fair enough, it's a new science. We need to lay the groundwork. But that doesn't tell us a whole lot that we didn't already know, given that there had to be some part of your brain or other processing language, since we know that you can do it. You know, it doesn't matter really where it is. Did that really give us a purchase on what the processes are by which we understand language and so on? But as I said, in the past 10 years, there have just been some absolutely amazing advances in the field of neuroscience, and people have moved very far away from talking about areas to talking about networks and talking about different, not a region that will light up, but linked regions and how they will light up in relation to each other. And again, I'm not a neuroscientist, so my knowledge of this is not as as deep as it should be in this area, but it's really been a huge change, and you can really see the science start to mature and get much more of a handle on some of these how and why questions, and not just the where question. I think that doesn't make it into the popular press quite as much. It's messier. It's more complicated.
Right.
Probably for those reasons, it is more realistic. And more will actually give us a purchase on the kinds of deep questions that we want to ask about human psychology, other than just these kind of where localization studies. But it's harder to talk about in a popular press article. You've got to describe a lot more technique.
Which is, I did something recently on like attachment attachment and resilience, and being resilience, studying resiliency being much more complicated, so it's not as getting as much press as maybe attachment is, right? And you talked about that reductive nature of some of these explanations. If they can be reduced to something more simple, they probably get a little more play. Would you agree with that? Or
yeah, I think so. And I think that's partially the nature of human psychology, which is my angle on it, you know, that we as thinking creatures, you know, we like those simple explanations that have a little bit of that reductive flavor. Sometimes they're correct. This is not, you know, a global reasoning failure. It is in the cases that I've carefully constructed in my lab to be so. But, you know, in general, you know, sometimes the simpler explanations are better. And we're attracted to them. They're easier to process cognitively and so on. So it's a perfectly understandable heuristic. You just have to know that it's a heuristic and will not work all the times. So it's partially an issue of human psychology. It's also partially an issue of the news and how news is reported, right? You could make headlines if you found the gene for, you know, whatever it is, intelligence.
Right.
If you found the brain area that controls intelligence or the brain network that is involved in intelligence, right? That's a good headline.
Yeah, right.
You know, what's not a good headline is, well, in some participants, but not others, occasionally there's this mid-level correlation between their performance on this particular IQ task and their activation in this network, which, by the way, is also involved in these 16 other things, but we're working on it.
Yeah,
like,
right.
No one's going to buy that magazine.
Yeah, right.
You know, I get it. So the reporters are in a bit of a bind here, too, or the headline writers are in a bit of a bind. And those two things, I think, combine to give a much more simplistic picture than is actually the case.
Great. Yes, we need to learn to lean into complexity, right?
Okay. Definitely.
So I was in a conversation, I think more than once, where it was discussed how neuroscientists, maybe you have some experience with this and can comment, but how neuroscientists get frustrated with kind of our folk, the therapists or counselors or psychologists, because the field often takes neuroscience explanations and translates them or uses them in ways that are questionable or any or not meant to be used. Or any thoughts about this? Or
Yes, I definitely feel that that frustration, and coming from both sides. So I think, again, not being as familiar as you are with the clinical field, I think in some ways that is a fair criticism. That people are very excited about these ideas for the reasons that we've discussed, and maybe they're doing things with them that are not quite ready for prime time, you know, for whatever purpose they might have, whether it's nice or nefarious. And I think the criticism is fair from the other side, right? So as a clinician or a therapist, you want the latest cutting-edge research to be able to bring to your patients, and it might be that neuroscience isn't there yet, or neuroscience is being hyped as being there when it's not, or the neuroscientists aren't doing the best job of communicating exactly the promises and pitfalls of whatever it is that they're finding. So I hear it from both sides. But again, I don't think that's a new problem. I think, you know, again, I see the same thing in education, and you can see the same thing in drug or other therapy developments in various other fields where the biology or the genetics might be on the edge of some breakthroughs about some of these new gene therapies or some of these personalized drugs and so on. And people, you know, again, whether their intentions are good or bad, might glom onto that for various reasons and then go run with it. Hmm. So I'm sympathetic to both sides, but it definitely happens.
Got it. Okay. My final question, actually, I guess I'm wondering what your thoughts are about this, because this is your area of research, about the future of neuroscience explanations in our field. And I guess, you know, maybe some idea what you think, what you're excited about, what has potential or what is still not there that's getting a lot of play, that kind of thing.
Yeah, that's a great question. I'm excited in general. Like I said, even in the last 10 years in which I've been watching this field, neuroscience has made some unbelievable breakthroughs and has developed some really exciting new techniques. So I'm glad that I get to be along for the ride a bit. You know, and I think that some of the things that we were just talking about in terms of this confluence of neuroscience and its implications for clinical practice and its implications for education and its implications for helping people to become better reasoners or better thinkers. I think those sorts of interdisciplinary intersections are really where the action is going to be. You know, let's think about from both sides, what do we want to know and what do we need to know in order to move forward? I think that kind of cross-disciplinary collaboration is always very difficult, but I think that's where really the most exciting developments are going to come from over the next couple of years.
Yeah, and I like that cross-disciplinary, or I don't know if you're familiar with Ken Gergen, he calls it that creative crosstalk that I really appreciate. And
yeah, that's a really good way to put it. And even just, you know, keeping the lines of dialogue open, I think it's incredibly helpful.
And to that message, I want to thank you for coming and talking to our audience a little bit about science what have you. This has been very informative for me, and I appreciate you taking the time to do that. And if anybody has questions for you, how might they be able to reach out to you? Or do you have a website?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, first, let me just thank you for inviting me, and it's been a pleasure to have this dialogue.
Great.
You can find me at dina.weisberg, D-E-E-N-A dot W-E-I-S-B-E-R-G, and that's at psych, P-S-Y-C-H dot upenn dot edu. Or you can search me, first name, last name. I'm actually Google unique as far as I can tell. So if you look me up, you will find my website, and feel free to ask me any follow-up questions you might have.
And I will link, I will link it on the show notes so you can easily access it. And one more time, I just want to thank you for coming out, and thank you.
Thank you, Chris. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks. Well, that's our show. And as always, thanks for listening. I still have t-shirts. If you would like a Radical Therapist t-shirt, you want to see what they look like, just go to the Radical Therapist Instagram page at the Radical Therapist, or the Radical Therapist Facebook page. Go check us out there. And you can see what the actually stickers or t-shirts look like. I have both. If you're interested, shoot me an email at theradicaltherapist@gmail.com. And of course, we have a website at theradicaltherapist.com. That's we can be found everywhere. We're even on Twitter at the Rad Therapist. If I'm a little, I don't know how to use Twitter, but I'm figuring it out. So, but if you're on Twitter, come find us at the Rad Therapist, and we'd love to connect with you via social media, as always. So, you know, I really appreciate the support. I appreciate you listening to this. Please share with a friend. And also, like I said earlier, if you're interested in videos, go to the Radical Therapist YouTube channel and please subscribe and share widely. It would be very much appreciated. So, well, that's it. And as always, my name is Chris Hoff, and this has been The Radical Therapist, and thanks for listening.